Hi, everybody. Today's pre-accident podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Worker Health and Safety. Now, they've got a new 11-module program, and the entire reason they're sponsoring the podcast is to introduce you to these modules.
So the first title we're going to release is more informational for organizations, and it's really designed to help educate the entire population related to the new view of safety. So we get into looking at how the best-in-class organizations are utilizing these techniques to drive improvement, but ultimately set up the rest of the content that will be coming online at the end of the first quarter. This first module will be available for free, and we'll announce soon when you're able to access that content as well as where. Thank you.
All this at ulworkplace.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast. Everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your loving host, Todd Conklin. Hey, thanks for being on the podcast, as always. God, it is so much fun hanging out with you guys. And, you know, it's just going crazy. More and more people are listening, and so more and more interesting stuff is happening, and that's really great. The year of slowness. That was a Freudian slip, because I think that's more true than false. The year of slowness is not as slow as I want it to be. Ding, dang it. But at least it's getting, I don't know, we're getting through winter. It's not getting, I was going to say it's getting close to not being winter, but it's not, seems to be the case. I mean, it's still cold and travel's still hard and stuff. Hope you're doing good. Man, the economy is just strange at every level, so that's been interesting. And this election is giving me so much to think about and to laugh about and to look at. And all those things are crazy as well. So today's podcast is interesting. Let's take you to a presentation in Slovenia. So earlier, I guess actually later last year, so in the late part of last year, they had a conference on reliability, and it was held in Slovenia, in Europe. And Rudy put this this conference together, and it was a great, great opportunity. And, of course, I was lined up to go and did all the planning and scheduling and put it on my calendar and stuff. And then ended up, because of travel, actually, honest to goodness, I could not get there in time to do the work. And so I ended up not being able to go, which always sucks and is disappointing and bad for me and bad for them. And everybody looks – I looked stupid. And so they ended up saying, well, could you do it by Skype? And Jim Howe, our buddy Jim Howe, put this together and said, let's try this. And I ended up actually doing my presentation with Jim Howe's help over the web. And Jim recorded it and said, you ought to put this on the podcast. And so that's exactly what today is. So if you'll sit back and relax, here's a conference presentation on the new view, safety differently, at the Slovenian Conference on High Reliability. So here you go.
So I wanted to start with you guys with a couple sort of important ideas. Number one, as you went through your journey the last couple days and talked about safety and resilience and reliability, I hope that you're picking up on the fact that we have to sort of shift our focus and stop looking at workers as a problem to be fixed and start looking at workers as a solution to be harnessed. And the key, most important message that I share all the time is the message that really the workers provide, I think, an opportunity to understand work is done in a way that's most meaningful. But to do that, and I think that's our biggest challenge right now, I think we have to look at the way we define reliability success or resilience success or even safety success, which is a phrase I use a lot. And to get into that, I think maybe the way to start my discussion with you guys is to tell you a little story. So I just worked with an incident. I wouldn't even call it an accident. In fact, I would probably call it something closer to a near miss. And I was working with an organization that had set up a temporary loading dock on a coast. Now, temporary, normally in my facility, I don't know what it's like for you guys, but in my facility, temporary is anything really less than 20 years, I guess. I don't know how they work temporary out. But in this case, they've been using this temporary loading dock for several years, longer than I would think the word temporary would be defined as. And they were loading super sacks onto these vessels. Now, a super sack is it's a big cloth or a big bag made of material that's got four loops on the top, and you hook the loops up onto the crane hook. The crew that had been loading the vessels had done it for months and months and months, and they've been very successful until the time they loaded the vessel that's in question. So it was basically the last load of the day. They, instead of hooking the loops up on the super sacks, what they did was take a rope and tie the super sack together at the top, a piece of nylon rope, and then they tied that nylon rope onto the crane hook. Then they lifted the load, and they were swinging the load over to load onto the vessel. Now, it's important that I tell you at this point that when they were swinging the load, they were swinging it through an exclusion area. In fact, they had barricades, and they had red X's on the beach. And as they were swinging that load that had been tied up, it's the really only one they tied up with a nylon rope. The rest of them, they just used the loops on the super sack to move the material. As they were swinging that load fell. Now, it didn't hurt anybody, and it didn't hurt anything, and the load fell right in the exclusion area. The question I would ask you, and it's the question that I asked this company, is that a success or a failure? If you drop a load and it doesn't hit anybody because you built an exclusion area and because your workers respected that exclusion area, is that a success or a failure? And my challenge to you is that our mindset as people who work in resilience and reliability, our mindset will determine how we handle, how we see that event will determine how we handle that event. And in this case, I will tell you, I think we have to introduce sort of a third category, a category that exists between success and failure. In fact, that third category, I think I would call a successful failure. And what's interesting about this event, and I hope I did a good enough job sort of describing the event itself hardly matters because they basically dropped a bag of sand on top of sand. But this idea that we can successfully fail really is important in understanding how we define both safety as an outcome and failure as an outcome. The place between is incredibly important. Because I will tell you, in this event, they successfully tested their safeguards, but they did not perform the function that they intended to perform. That's our challenge. Our challenge is to realize that what we manage, really, when we talk about reliability and resilience, the things that the guys have talked to you about for the last couple of days, what we manage really is the way we think of and use these terms. So let's look at a couple slides if I can make this work. About time to get off that one. There we go. Let's start by redefining how we understand safety. Safety is not an outcome to be achieved. In fact, probably our challenge is that we struggle constantly with the idea that with the absence of a null set, it's hard to measure things that didn't happen. We struggle to find a way to sort of determine if we're successful. Part of what we've done is created a negative-based understanding and definition of what safety is. Safety is not the absence of accidents. Safety is really the presence of defenses. And in that crane story I told you, what's so valuable about that story is not that it failed. The failure itself is pretty predictable. You tie a big sack up with a nylon rope. You lift that nylon rope. And if the sack's heavy enough, the knot will not make it. It's not going to live through the lift. The fall is actually quite predictable. What's amazing is how they manage that predictability and how they created defenses or barriers or controls. But what they really did, and this is the challenge I think we all deal with, is they really created the capacity for that system to fail. And that capacity, that's what we want to try to understand and how we want to manage this. A reliable system is not a system that doesn't fail. A reliable system is a system that has the capacity to expand with variability. Now, that idea is so important. And I'm hoping you got to talk and struggle and discuss and share those ideas with each other, because that redefining of our sort of overall idea empowers you guys in the conference room today to create a system that doesn't drive on outcomes, it drives on the ability to expand. But to get there, let's take it one step further. I think I can describe, no matter where you are in the world, what it's like to work. So let's start with a sort of a quick definition. Here's a blank screen. It gets no more pristine than this. I think workers are as safe as they need to be, right? Without being overly safe in order to get work done. So I want to challenge you on this, because this is a classic way to present the idea of what Hallnagel calls the efficiency thoroughness trade-off. But what I would share with you is this is that place where work and workers meet. And maybe this little definition is a little harder to understand through a GoToMeeting conference, but workers who do work absolutely do these things. Workers are as safe as they need to be because they want to be as safe as they need to be. Let's assume nobody wants to get hurt or cut their hand. That's fair. But the idea of being too safe is a kind of a misnomer, because the question I would ask you is, once you're safe, do you need to be safer? Now, a way to think about this is when you drive to work. Now, not at the conference, because this is a kind of a special time. But next week, when you go back to work and you drive to work, if you drive to work, how do you know while you're driving you're safe enough? It's a really good question. Now, some of you in this room are thinking, well, because I get to work and I didn't have a wreck. Well, that's a great illustration of how safety is easily and very effectively measured if we look at it as an outcome. But to be really fair, that's not the question I ask. How do you know you're safe while you're driving to work? And the quick answer to that is, really, you don't. You're constantly managing the fluid nature of risk. And one of the things we have to talk about is that we won't live in a world with zero risk. Even though our tools assume risk is permanent and our assessments take snapshots of risk pictures, the risks your workers deal with are very, very fluid. In fact, if you talked much about staff rides and wildland fires, and those are really important areas to think of and think about, one of the things you realize right away is that the notion of risk permanence is really just a theoretic idea, that when workers work, they're constantly really managing risk. And so we start talking about not the absence of risk. What we start talking about, in fact, is risk competency. Can we create a system where workers actually manage risk in real time, realizing that risk is constantly and quite fluidly changing? And that becomes a really important part of this. You know, the transition from how do you know you're safe when you drive to work to the transition to how do you know you're safe while you're working is actually a relatively easy journey to make. How do your workers know they're safe while they're doing work? And the answer is, they don't. Unless we look at safety as an outcome, it's remarkably difficult to manage and to measure. So we have to sort of look at safety as a part of the process. And that's where workers become this really important resource for us to use. That idea that we see workers as a problem to be fixed is not nearly as effective when we think about the fluid nature of risk as the idea of seeing workers as a solution to be harnessed. Because no matter what you think about the big slide I'm showing you in the room right now, what's most remarkable about this, as complex as this idea is, your workers are incredibly good at it. Your workers are just as safe as they need to be without being overly safe in order to get work done until they're not. And those variable failures we deal with become quite extreme. And in fact, here's the crazy thing. Things that never happen, happen all the time. Variability and failure is really pretty present in our systems. But what happens is workers become really good at detecting, correcting, and managing it before it happens. So where's that take us? Well, let's look at this idea. To understand failure, we must first understand our reaction to failure. We must first think about how we, in the room you're in right now, or the room I'm in right now, or managers who are in their offices probably this very moment, how do they respond to failure? If we drop a bag off a crane, is that a failure or a success? Or is it a successful failure? Think of it kind of like this. This is my picture of a sharp stick. And if we populate this sharp stick picture, at the very pointy end of the stick are the workers, behind them the frontline soups, managers, and leaders, behind them the company and the customer, and at the very blunt end of the stick is the regulator. Now, the question I'd ask you is, who's most likely to get hurt in this model? Well, the answer you'd tell me, if I were there, you'd look me in the eye and give me a wink and say, the workers. The workers have the highest injury potential. The crazy thing is that who's got the most influence over the things that hurt the workers? That moves in the opposite direction. The highest influence over the system actually moves to the blunt end of the stick. And where you are on the stick colors how you see the world. So where's this take us? Well, ultimately, there's three parts to every failure. There's the context. That's everything that leads up to the consequence. And then there's the retrospective understanding of the event after the event transpires. Context, consequence, and retrospect. Now, give this slide a quick look. Concentrate. Okay, everybody looking? You in the back, look. Okay, everyone looking? Good. Which one of these three parts of an event, in your opinion, is least interesting to the overall resilience and reliability challenge in your organization? Least interesting. That's a difficult question. Is it the context? Is it the consequence? Or is it the retrospect? I'll give you a moment to think about it, but let me jump ahead and give you the answer. The crazy thing about our world as we go into these discussions is that the least interesting part of an accident is the consequence. What happened is the only part of any event you have that obeys the laws of physics. What happened is just what happened. What's interesting is not what happened, it's just an outcome. Why do people fall down? Well, the quick answer, believe it or not, is gravity. Why do people cut their hands? Well, the quick answer would be sharp objects, soft tissue, right? If you drop 500 pounds of steel on a worker's foot, you're going to smash the worker's foot. If you want to invent a foot smashing machine, you need 500 pounds of steel on a worker's foot. What's interesting about this slide is really how the context and the retrospect tell a huge story both before and after the event that has much more detailed material than the actual consequence itself. The story we deal with when we talk about reliability and resilient systems is not the story of the consequence, it's the story of the context. And what we're asking you to do, and what the world is asking us to do, is to move from reacting to consequence to responding to context. But profoundly, if you really push me, what I think is most interesting about this model is how different the front end is of an event from the back end of an event. The context from the retrospect. Because the context, the workers zigging and zagging and moving through a system. The back end we've put very distinct order on this process. Our challenge is to live in the context. Workers don't really cause failure. Cause assumes that linear predictability and actually gives us consequence preference. What workers do is trigger failure. Those guys didn't drop that load. The load did drop, but it dropped because of gravity. What those guys did was trigger a set of latent conditions on the side of the beach when they were loading the vessels that created the outcome that they got. We want seductively unambiguous information about events. Our companies really want seductively unambiguous events. The problem is we don't really have seductively unambiguous information about events. Look at this next picture. Now, there are 46 pallets on top of that van. This picture is taken in the United States during a rainstorm. I don't know if I should tell you where it was taken, but let's just say the place it was taken rhymes with the word Atlanta, Georgia in the United States. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say where. What's interesting about this is we can look at this picture, and if we want that seductively unambiguous consequence-based information, this is relatively a high-risk operation. In fact, it's a high enough risk operation, I probably wouldn't follow this guy on the road. But I'd actually tell you the story of this failure is not the story of pallets flying off the van. It's how we got into a position where this made sense. And part of our challenge as we move to reliability is shifting from the traditional why question, which we tell people to ask all the time, to a much more context-rich how question. Why always takes us to consequence and beyond. In fact, why, we're focusing on worker incentive. Why would you put 46 pallets on a van? Well, clearly the answer is going to be efficiency. I only want to make one trip and I only have a van. The real question you want to ask is how. How do we put 46 pallets on a van? And to answer that question, we now tell the story of complex, adaptive problem solving, creativity, problem solving, and improvisation. That takes us to this idea. Your workers are masters of complex, adaptive behavior. In fact, we rely on workers constantly identifying problems and solving them in real time. And we hope they do it while being safe enough without being too safe. See how all this is kind of building on each other? When I was asking you guys about driving to work, and I was asking you about driving to work, I was thinking of this slide. This slide's a really interesting slide. We know when it's clearly safe to do work. We also know when it's clearly not safe to do work. The problem is we don't spend any time in 100% safe. And thank God we don't spend our time in 100% dangerous. We live in the middle, the gray area, the uncertain interpretation of when work is safe enough. And what's interesting about this is that the lines that delineate safe from unsafe are constantly moving. They're constantly being negotiated by that context. In fact, when do we know exactly when these lines are solid? When do I know exactly when the worker should have zigged instead of zagging? When do I know exactly the precise moment when the worker moved from safe to unsafe? And the answer is that consequence. After something happens, this model looks like this. This model is super clean. In fact, this model is seductively unambiguous. The problem is this model isn't accurate. This is not what happened. This is the outcome. That model with the wiggling line, safe, gray, unsafe, that's where the event took place. This is what the event looked like after it took place, which takes us really to the most important idea that we'll talk about this morning, at least in my little section. I'm sure you're going to talk about amazing stuff, and that's this idea. This black line represents the way we believe work happens. This is how we believe fires are fought, or ships are loaded, or televisions are installed, or roads are maintained. This is how we believe work happens. This is what we plan for. This is what we do our hazard assessments for. This is how we buy equipment. It's how we train people. It's how we resource jobs. It's how we set schedules. It's how we create budgets. This is the work that we think is going to happen. That's the black line. If that's the black line, what's this blue line? Reality. The blue line is really interesting because the blue line reflects real work. In fact, the blue line is how work happens. The black line is how we believe work happens. And what's crazy, and I hope this is illustrating beautifully on your end, is that the blue line really represents workers not only underperforming your procedures and expectations, but also overperforming your procedures and expectations. In fact, I will tell you, probably your workers spend as much time, if not more time, overperforming your systems than they do underperforming your systems. The crazy thing is that the blue line is really the only part of this model, this cartoon we're drawing, that's actually real. The black line is not real. The black line is imagined. It's an imagined way we do work. When workers actually do work, they're involved in sort of constant variability, and they manage that variability in order to create production. If I ask this question, if you only did exactly what your procedure said, you only did exact rote compliance to your SOP, you did no creativity, no improvisation, no problem solving, you did exactly what the rules said, no more and no less, probably you'd look me in the eye and say, production would stop. We rely on workers adaptively solving problems in real time, and because we rely on them adaptively solving problems in real time, we get variability. The quick answer to this slide is the story of how work is done is not the story of the procedures and the policies and the SOP, the black line. The story of work and how work is done is the story of the blue line. When you think about operational learning, when you think about understanding your systems, when you think about weak signals, when you think about imagining and really analyzing successful work, you have to think about the work that's done, not the work we think is being done. So the blue line becomes really important. It's the story of failure for certain, but it's also, probably more importantly for us, the story of success. So let's add one more line, right? As workers drift away from expected work, they introduce a whole new set of hazards. And if the blue line hits the red line, well, that's not good, right? I mean, if we take a linear mode, because that would be a failure. What I think is interesting about this model is the fact that the gap between the blue line and the black line seems significant, but the gap between the blue line and the red line is how workers manage risk in real time. Workers are as safe as they need to be without being overly safe in order to get work done. We have to get beyond sort of bringing the blue line to the black line. We have to get work as it's actually done closer to the procedures that we want work done with. That's kind of a Tayloristic idea. That's the idea that there's only one right way to do work. We really want to understand actual work versus actual hazard. And that's a really important part of what happens. Ultimately, we have to design systems that are tolerant of both mistake and violation, because the outcome is agnostic to the cause. And I know that's a much different way to see the world, and I want to challenge you. My goal for this presentation, well, one is to get through it, and two is to really leave you with more questions. But if we design systems that are only tolerant of the black line, then when we have a mistake, an unintentional deviation from an expected outcome, we get into trouble. Or when we have a violation, somebody purposely varies our process in order to create efficiency, those outcomes are agnostic to that potential problem. that takes us to our most important weapon. And if you've talked to, gosh, almost anybody, David, Jim, any of the guys, Igor, the guys that are there, they'll tell you that ultimately all of this really boils down to the ability to learn. Learning is how event prevention happens. And this idea of being sensitive to weak signals is really the idea that a reliable organization can spot an action that's happening. They don't wait for an action to happen. So the question I'd leave you with is this journey worth it? Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the payoff worth the effort? I like this slide. I hope it translates well and looks good in the conference room there. Well, here's what I'll tell you. Listening and identifying weak signals, understanding how successful work is done, learning all the time about that blue line, allows us to identify problems that are small enough so we have the capacity to solve that problem. But watch carefully. I'm going to push the button again, and one part of this model will not change. If we wait for consequence, so we stop responding to context and wait for consequence, what happened is that the event gets larger, but our solution space, our capacity, does not grow accordingly. In fact, our capacity is limited, but events have infinite potential to create catastrophic outcome. That's important. And really, that's what I wanted to share with you guys today. I wish I was there. It would be great, especially since I heard you ate cake. Cake is my favorite thing. We have to sort of understand that as we go on this journey, we really have two choices. Carl talks about this a lot. Sydney talks about this a lot. And lots of the people in the room with you right now practice this. It's pretty simple. When something happens, you have the choice to blame and punish or to learn and improve, but you can never do both. If you choose to blame and punish, you lose the ability to learn, and learning is very key. If you choose to learn, you've given up the ability to blame and punish. Ultimately, we're redefining reliability. We're redefining safety. Safety is not an outcome to be achieved. It's not the absence of accidents. Safety is actually the presence of defenses.
So there you have it, a international conference topic given from a hotel room sitting on a nice chair. Kind of basic, and I sort of tricked you because maybe you needed the slides, maybe you didn't, I don't know. Either way, it's by special request because they really wanted to put this on here, and I think it's all right. I mean, it's a pretty good way to sort of talk about the basics of reliability and how human performance and safety differently all fits together. That is a great thing to do. Special thanks to Jim Howe for doing all the work on that. It's a fun podcast, that's for sure. Thanks for listening, you guys, and thanks for being a part of it. It is always good to have you on board this ride. As always, do something fun every single day and learn something new, will you? And until then, remember this, be safe.